The gospel reading is from Matthew chapter 9, verses 9 through 13. As Jesus was walking along, he saw a man called Matthew sitting at the tax booth, and he said to him, "Follow me." And he got up and followed him. And as he sat at dinner in the house, many tax collectors and sinners came and were sitting with him and the disciples. When the Pharisees saw this, they said to the disciples, "Why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners?" But when he heard this, he said, "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. Go and learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice. For I have come to call not the righteous, but sinners." The word of the Lord.
Several years ago, my wife and I had the opportunity to live for a year in Cairo. It's where I spent my internship in seminary. And we had this amazing year. And during this year, we got the chance to do a little bit of traveling around the area. And one of the places we traveled to was this beach resort along the Sinai Peninsula. And if you remember your geography from school, the Sinai Peninsula is this little piece of land that connects on one side Africa and on the other side Asia. On the African side is Egypt, and then is the Sinai, and then on the other side is Israel and the rest of Asia beyond it. And what was interesting as I went there was this kind of contradictory landscape that the Sinai has. On the surface level, if you're just walking around or driving around and you take in the surrounding area, it's just this incredibly hot, dry, and desolate place. There are some mountains kind of in view, but otherwise there's really not a lot in your way. And, you know, I don't think if I've ever been to a place with less life that you can see just around you. I remember when we were driving in, and I kind of was noticing this, so I started just looking around in all directions as far as the eye can see. And the only life I found, and this is true, was one tiny bush and one wild camel in just hundreds of miles and miles around us. But then you head to the Sinai coast, and there's beaches, and they have some resorts there. And if you rent some snorkeling gear, you can go under the water and dip your head under and see what's under there, and everything completely changes. It turns out that the Sinai is a world-renowned snorkeling spot, and that's because it is just teeming with life. I remember we stuck our heads under there, did some snorkeling, and there is every color of the rainbow, a fish and aquatic life, and these beautiful plants and coral reefs, and just an amazing amount of life just under the surface. So there's a contradiction in the landscape of the Sinai. And as we hear in our Old Testament story, 3,000 years ago, there was another contradiction in the Sinai, but it wasn't about landscape, it was about the desires of the Israelites as they were doing this journey. This story takes place in a story we call the Exodus, which means kind of the moving, the journey. And it's this journey for the Israelites between Egypt, where they were slaves, God had rescued them from Pharaoh, and then they were to be led to the Promised Land, but they don't get there right away because the Sinai is in between them and the Promised Land. And like I said, it's this hard, desolate place. In the Bible, it's called the wilderness. The Sinai is called the wilderness. So it's this harsh climate as they do their journey, but God isn't ignorant. God knows this. And so it says that every morning, God would feed the Israelites with the spiritual bread called manna. And so they would go out in the morning, and it said that they could collect what they needed, and it would keep them alive. It wasn't fine cuisine, it wasn't delicious, but it was enough to keep them alive so that they could continue their journey towards freedom. But as we hear in our reading today, the Israelites are not happy campers at all. They're sick of this landscape. They're sick of this hard journey. They're sick of the food. And so they bitterly complain to God. And it's almost kind of a funny thing, but here's what they say. The rabble among them had a strong craving, and the Israelites also wept again and said, "If only we had meat to eat. We remember the fish we used to eat in Egypt for nothing, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, the garlic, but now our strength is dried up and there is nothing at all but this manna to look at." And you know, this contradiction is almost funny. God has rescued these people from slavery, right, where they're literally being whipped and worked to death. And he's, you know, which is what they wanted. It says the Israelites cried out for help, so God rescued them as they wanted. And he's kept them alive through this brutal climate so that they can reach the promised land. But now that they've got what they want, they don't want what they've got. It turns out many of them would rather be slaves eating melons than endure the long, hard journey that would take them to true freedom. Now, we could be tempted to sort of laugh at their contradiction and to look at them and say, oh, how foolish are they? Because, you know, it does seem kind of crazy to want to exchange freedom for melons. But actually, this isn't an unusual thing at all. You know, one of the things that makes us strange as human beings is we have the ability to simultaneously really, really want something and at the same time really not want the exact same thing. Maybe you know what I'm talking about. How many of us want to be healthy, but we don't really enjoy exercising? That's me. I have sort of this decorative membership to the YMCA that I rarely use, especially when it's warm outside. When it gets colder, I use it a little bit. But you know, if we go looking, there are lots of ways we live and breathe contradiction in our lives. How many of us want to be less distracted by technology, but we don't actually want to put down our phones? Or how many of us have wanted to reconnect with a family member or a friend that we haven't talked to for a long time, but we won't pick up our phones? Or how many of us want to stop drinking, but we can't put down the bottle? Or we want to be reconciled to someone who we've had some pain with, but we don't want to say, I'm sorry, or I was wrong. Or we want to be more generous, or we want to do something different with our money, but we don't want to save or stop spending. I could go on and on, because once you start digging, and it's different for all of us on what our contradictions are, but once we start digging, it's so easy to find ways in which we as human beings are walking, talking contradictions. And spirituality is definitely one of these places where this is totally true also. You know, when it comes to spiritual transformation, I think for almost all of us, it's something that we simultaneously really want and also don't want. You know, for instance, how many times do we want God in our lives and yet we don't necessarily give serious time to our spiritual growth? Or how many times do we say, God, I wish you would speak to us, but truly, we don't really want to hear God say anything that might be challenging, that might challenge our way of living or thinking or being. Another way to put this is that we want the promised land, but we don't want the hard journey that would get us there. And what this all comes down to is that spiritual growth is hard. There's always a part of us that resists it. There's always other things that are attractive that we can be doing instead. There's always other things fighting for our hearts and minds and spirits. So what do we do in our spiritual lives when we know that we need to grow? We might even know how we need to grow, but we're not quite sure how to do it, right? What do we do when we know we need to grow, but we're not sure how to grow? Well, we'll get to that in a second, but first I want to bring in this other story we had today from Jesus' life. In this story, there's a guy named Matthew who Jesus calls into discipleship with this really simple two-word invitation: follow me. And this in itself, we may not realize it at first, but it's a pretty remarkable thing, because it says that Matthew is a Jewish guy who is also a tax collector of Rome. And what this meant is that he was probably hated among his own people because, let's remember, Rome was the oppressor of the Jews. Rome had come in violently with an army and taken over, and they were their colonizers. And so if you were a Jewish tax collector of Rome, you would have been seen as a collaborator with the oppressor, right? You're working for the person oppressing your people. So again, we're talking about a person who has a contradiction in their life. But Jesus looks at him and he decides that even people with contradictions in their lives can be part of his spiritual family and part of his ministry, which of course enrages people. And then Jesus makes it worse by going to either his house or one of his friend's house, and it says it was this house that was full of what the community liked to call sinners, right? The people who everyone knew weren't the right people. And of course, mainly the religious folk complain. And so Jesus comes back at them with this famous quote. He says, it's not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. And then he says this line, which we don't often notice as much: go and learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice. So coming back to the question of what do we do in our spiritual lives when we know we need to grow, but we're not sure how? The gospel answer in today's story is we follow Jesus. And notice that this kind of faith, when Jesus says, follow me, it's not just something we do with our heads, like believing facts. But Jesus, you know, in this story doesn't just say believe, he says follow. And follow means movement in some sense. Now, what it means to follow Jesus today in this world may be a little more puzzling because he's not literally there saying, hey, follow me, you know, like a Pied Piper that we can literally follow. And that's, I think, where the last line in this section comes in handy. He says, go and learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice. And again, we hear this move, this word not of stagnation, but movement. Go, right? Go. Don't just think about it, but go and learn what this means. And then according to Jesus, what we need to go and learn what it means is that God desires mercy and not sacrifice. That God may be okay, may even encourage us to do some rituals, to show up for worship, to do this kind of thing. Those things are all great. But according to this story, if we really want to grow spiritually, Jesus' advice is to go offer someone mercy. Mercy meaning unearned, unexpected love. And certainly if we look at Jesus' life, his life was all about giving love, like in this very story, to the people who weren't usually given much love. Maybe to the people who were distinctly denied love, who were said, you shouldn't love these people. Go love someone who the world says you shouldn't love. So another way to put this is that growing in faith is about service. And I think that's because mature faith only really happens when we figure out how our faith doesn't just serve us, doesn't just make us feel good, but we figure out how we can use it to serve others, which is exactly the same principle as how love works, right? Love is wonderful to receive, but love is real when we learn how to reflect it back to others and share it with others. A friend of mine is a recovering alcoholic who's been active for years in Alcoholics Anonymous, and she was recently sharing about the AA program and about one of the principles in this program is that as an alcoholic, even if you enter recovery, your recovery isn't complete until you become, in some way, a mentor to others who are also in recovery, especially those who are earlier in on the journey than you. And so they're expected to have each other's back. If you become a mentor, it's expected that if someone you're mentoring needs you, if they're struggling to stay on the wagon, that they can call you any time of day or night, and that you will be there for them, you will listen to them, you will help them. And the mindset goes, it's not just that you should help people as a mentor when you're in recovery because that will help them, though of course you should help them because it helps them, but it's also this idea that helping others actually reinforces your own recovery, right? It makes your own recovery stronger. She shared a story about a woman who was a mentor to another woman, and this other woman was struggling with wanting to relapse. She hadn't done it yet. But she was calling this lady saying, you know, I just need your help. I can't stop thinking about drinking. I just want it so bad. And she would call over and over and over, you know, just saying, I can't stop thinking about drinking. I can't stop thinking about drinking. And the mentor was there for her. But eventually, you know, this just kept happening over and over. And so eventually the mentor said, you know, what you need to do is stop thinking about yourself and go help somebody. Right? There's obviously some energy you have in your life, and you need to harness that towards something else. Go help somebody. And the woman said, well, I don't have anything to offer. You know, I've been a mess for so many years. I don't have anything to offer. And the mentor responded, of course you have something to offer. Just thinking about it. And she's like, no, I can't do anything. I can't help anyone in any way. And finally, this mentor said, well, go to a park and pick up trash or something. And it sounds kind of flippant, but I think it's true that at some point we have to learn how our recovery, not just in alcoholism, but in life, in spiritual life, isn't complete until we learn to help others in their spiritual journey. It should be the same motto of the church, right? That our faith isn't complete until we learn to use it to serve others. And actually, that's more and more how I think about it. I've been here for several years now, and I would say one of the most rewarding things for me is, you know, I've seen kids now who are quite young, who've gotten a little older, and now they're teenagers or maybe in college. And what makes it really click to me, when I feel like something has happened in ministry, not just what I've done, but what the whole church has done, what God has done, is when I see kids who grew up in the church decide to give back in some way, in a way that no one's forcing them to do or telling them they have to do for extra credit, but just people wanting to give back out of the generosity of their hearts. And I'm thinking about how some of our youths, for instance, go and teach Sunday school after they get out of confirmation. I mean, what a beautiful thing that they want to teach other young people about the faith as they received it. I think about others who have organized food drives, not when we ask them to. They've just kind of done it out of the goodness of their hearts. I think about kids who can't wait to go on the next service trip and help build houses or connect with people in faith. And of course, it's not all about the youths either. I'm sure if we asked each other, there are hundreds of ways that our faith has called us into service. And that's why we have this theme today, that service changes everything. That as our faith matures, it becomes something that's not just for us, but is for everyone. And so remember that even if you have contradictions in your life, welcome to the club, and Jesus says you're the perfect person to be part of God's family and to serve in God's ministry. And he says, go out and find what it means to offer mercy to another person. And if you can't think of any ways, go pick up trash at a park or something. Amen.